All right, let's ask God's blessing on our meeting. Father, we bow and we thank you for the chance again to get together with those of like mind who want to learn from your word and those that will be listening to this on the forum and hopefully many others around the world. We ask your blessing on this study, that you would open our hearts and minds to the spiritual things that you have for us and help us in the teaching so that we do cover material that is pertinent and useful to all of us in our lives. And we thank you now for this opportunity. We ask your blessing on us in Christ's name. Amen. Okay. Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, that verse that says, where two or three are gathered together in my name, there will I be also, you know. So we just have to ask ourselves, are we gathered here in his name? Is that our purpose for being here? You know, is that why we're here? Is that our sole primary purpose, you know? Well, then he's here. He's here. He's in this room. Not that he isn't in this room if we're not gathered in his name. Because he's in this room even if you're here, you know, having a sex orgy, you're getting drunk. He's here. You know, he's there, or wherever you are, he's there. But he's not there in the sense of being your spiritual guide, you see. That's what we're all about here, to receive something supernatural. That somehow in this study and so on, there's got to be something supernatural that we couldn't get without him. Or we wouldn't even pray. Why pray that he'd be here? We don't need him. We just use our intellect, you know, and do. Well, I've learned a long time ago that intellect stuff only goes so far, you know. I mean, I use eSword, which is a technical, analytical, electronic device that can just give you all the scriptures and you can hit the numbers and get Strong's definitions and so on instantly. But that only goes so far. I have people write me all the time and they say, Ray, what Bible do you use so that I can understand these things like you do? And I mean, I don't mean to be arrogant, but I think to myself, what? You think you understand the scriptures by a better translation? You know? Actually, the translations that are out there are pretty good. All of them. People think, well, you're so down on the King James. Excuse me, that's a King James. Most of the Bibles I have back there are King James, and I have some that are virtually, totally wore out. King James, right? Granted, Aeonius does not mean eternity. That's not accurate. But then again, you know, even Concordant, which is probably the single best translation I know of, along with Rotherham's and Young's and Wayneton and some of those, you know. But they have some crazy things too, you know. In the Concordant, when the disciples got together and broke bread, they masticated together. You know, what? Masticated? What kind of nonsense is that? They ate together. This is supposed, you're supposed to translate from one language to another, not give a word for word. You know what I mean? True, it does mean masticate, but that also, when you translate it, means eating. You know. Anyhow, how did I get off on this? I don't know, but I did. But anyway, I mean, all the translation, it's in there. Listen, the gospel is in there. It's in all of them. Okay, it's in there. You know, the idea of burning in hell forever as opposed to receiving chastisement that will correct you for a certain period of time. I mean, there's a big difference there in that, you know. And we can make those changes. Somebody said recently, for about the third or fourth time now, I think, said, Ray, why don't you come out, since you're such an expert on Hebrew and Greek and you explain these things, so why don't you come out with your own translation? Are you crazy? An expert on Hebrew and Greek? I don't even know English, let alone Hebrew and Greek. I mean, I just stumble through. You know, people say, well, you think, no, I don't. You lie. I do not think I'm some great one, that I'm some great intellect, that I'm a scholar, you know, or some great peer of academia. Or no. I've never said that. All I've ever said is I'm a teacher. Good, bad, or indifferent, I'm a teacher. That's what I am. That's the only claim I make. I'm a teacher. I teach. You say, well, you don't teach very well. Well, that's fine. You know, everybody's entitled to their opinion. It's a free country. But anyway, just a few words, a few phrases that are wrong. All the Bibles have, you know, I don't care what Bible you have. If you read the whole thing, would you be of the opinion that we should obey God or not obey God? What do you think would be the overall feeling you would get from the Scriptures if you read any Bible there is? I think it'd be self-evident, you know. We ought to obey God. Right? And you ought to conduct yourself with a certain morality. You shouldn't fornicate with your neighbor's wife. You shouldn't steal. You shouldn't bear false witness against people in a court of law. And you shouldn't do those things. I don't care how stupid a church or doctrine, you know, there might be. You can't screw those things up. Those things are in there from Genesis to Revelation. And so then you get down to, why is all the hocus pocus? Carnal mind that deceived people. All right, today we're going to talk about the shortest subject in the whole Bible. The shortest subject in the Bible. Church government. Okay. Church government. It's interesting. Every one of us in this room came out of the Worldwide Church of God. And that's, you know, and if Gordon were here, he's sick today. If Gordon were here, he'd be another one. You know, Harry, our contribution man here, out of the Worldwide. You know, Kathy, our one and only female moderator on the forum, you know, out of the Worldwide. My luncheon buddy over here, Bob, go out for lunch twice a week, Worldwide. Dennis, our webmaster, came out of the Worldwide. I mean, Dennis is from Michigan. Bob is from Mobile. You were born in Florida, right? Where?
Nebraska,
excuse me. Gordon from Florida, and Kathy from Mississippi, and me from Pennsylvania. Now, what are the chances we would all come out of the Worldwide Church of God be sitting in this room today? I mean, it's a little ironical, don't you think?
Did a little bit of good in the
blind. Well, I don't know if I'd go that far, but let's say some good came out of some of the evil that he did. Well, no, some of the good is good, actually. You know, people think, well, you're angry. You sound like you were hurt. And so, no, I'm not. And there's nothing in my writings to suggest that. You know, there really isn't. I had somebody sent me a really nice email this week and said, wow, so you've blown me away. I've never heard anybody teach like this, you know. They said, but you are so, so cocky. And he said, well, I guess maybe that's part of it. That's what keeps them coming back or something like that. Now, I'll write her, it was a woman, and I'll say, could you give me an example of that? See? And they won't be able to. It's just a feeling they get. They can't make a statement. I've asked that many times. Would you give me an example of this anger toward people? Or like, give me an example. And they can't. They can't. It's not in there. They think it is. It's not. Then, of course, many times what I'll do, you know, they say, you should be more understanding and more loving. And so, and I see, oh, you mean like this. And then I give them Matthew 23, where Christ said, you fools. You blind guys, you hypocrites, you whitened septic tanks, you generation of snakes. I said, you know, I've never called anybody, these ministers of the world, I've never called them snakes or whitened sepulchers, never. But you want me to be more like that? And then they just get frustrated or angry or whatever. The thing is, here's what I do that they don't like. I speak with authority about God's word. If the Bible says it, I speak it with authority. They don't like it. That's what they don't like. if I apologize and say, well, you know, maybe it could be this way, and have you ever considered, you know, that, you know, Christ might have said this or that, you know, and just very, you know, pussy-footed, shallow, weak, wimpy, you know, that's okay. Don't speak with authority. And what was the biggest thing that they had against Christ immediately when the Pharisees and the religious leaders came out to listen? What was the one thing they immediately, they just sent their hair up on end? He spoke not like the other Pharisees and so on, but with authority. He spoke with authority. Yet Christ was humble. He said, of my own self, I can do nothing. I can say that. Of my own self, I can do nothing. You know? But that doesn't mean you can't speak with authority about something that you know is right. But then people say, well, you get a little pushy there. Well, so be it. If it's true, it's true. All right, church government, the shortest subject in the Bible. You'll see why I say that in a minute. Do you obey those that have the rule over you? Then he sent me an article from the Wall Street Journal. I guess that he got off the forum. And it was, the subject was the backlash against tithing. And I just took one little excerpt here. There was this one guy, when he objected to his church's instruction to tithe, Kirk Cesarita took it up with the church leaders. And, you know, explained that, you know, he didn't think that was scriptural and so on. Anyway, they sent back a letter to him. And the pastor in the letter closed with this verse from Hebrews 13:17. Obey your leaders and submit to them. Okay? For they keep watch over your souls as those who will give an account, and so on. But the part I wanted to bring out, obey. See, this is what the minister was telling. You know what the scriptures say, don't you, Kurt Cesarito? The scriptures say, obey your leaders and submit to them. Meaning he, as a pastor or a teacher of the gospel, he had authority over him, and they needed to obey and submit to that authority. In Hebrews 13:7, it says, remember them that have the rule over you. And in Hebrews 13:24, salute all them that have the rule over you, and all the saints. They of Italy salute you. So, let me see a show of hands. How many of you obey those that have the rule over you? Can I see your hands?
That worked, though.
Okay, you obey those who have the rule over you. Okay, that was kind of a trick question, so I won't say how many hands went up or didn't go up. Because that is not what the scriptures say. That's what the King James says. And it's not totally wrong, but it is somewhat wrong. And you get a wrong feeling. And I don't know what translation this man was quoting from, obey your leaders and submit to them. But we do find three times in the 13th chapter of Hebrew, this phrase, you know, remember, obey, and whatever, them that have the rule over you. Now later on I'm going to show you a better translation of those scriptures. All major churches and religions have a rule. They have a government. They have a hierarchy, you see. And I put down here the Catholic Church, for example. You know, they have elders and bishops, deacons and lower level, you know, the Knights of Columbus, you know, and so on, which are not really, you know, ordained priests per se. And then they have the priests, bishops, archbishops, cardinal, and a pope. Okay, that's the hierarchy. And those people have real authority in the Catholic Church. Now, on the negative side, recently, I think it was in the range of $65 million. The church paid out as kind of hush money or damages to those people in the Boston area who were molested by this hierarchy, say, of priests and so on. Well, but by what authority Can they take people's money, poor people's, widows' mites and whatever, $65 million worth of those mites, and pay it to people that have been sexually molested by the priests? By what authority can they do that? Well, by the authority of the church. You owe the church money. They take your money. They do with it what they will. And if it requires blackmail money, they'll play back blackmail money. That's real authority, you see. You know, back in the roaring 20s or whatever, I guess that was the period where Al Capone and, you know, Pretty Boy Floyd and all these people were operating. You know, they would require the merchants in the cities, Chicago, New York, and so on, to pay them protection money. Okay? If you were a merchant, you didn't pay them protection money, and they would protect you too. It isn't that you just stole your money. You paid them money, they protect you. I mean, they would look out for you that, you know, hoodlums or whatever didn't rob your store or whatever. There was a certain amount that they would do. But, you know, by what authority could they make you pay the money? Or not only wouldn't they protect you, they themselves might burn down your business. You see, that's real authority. That's fear. Those people didn't want to give that money. They feared the consequences. And we can see immediately that that's evil, can't we? Can't we see that that's criminal? Isn't this exactly what the governments of churches and religions do? Of course it is. It's all based on fear. The doctrines are based on fear. And the giving of the money is based on fear, because if you don't, then they'll get you with the doctrines, you see. If you don't pay your tithes, you're robbing from God and you'll go to hell. I mean, that's as simple as it is. And people say, no, we shouldn't come to Christ or be Christians out of fear. Listen, I can't tell you how many leaders that sit there up on that ivory gold-gilded stage of TBN have personally given testimonies that the first and major reason they accepted Christ or became a Christian was fear of going to hell. I heard it with my own ears numerous times. That all major churches, denominations, have a church government, and they usually have a national, regional, national, and or international headquarters. Does that word ring a bell? Headquarters. And the work. Headquarters. They have a headquarters. And from that headquarters is issued the government of that denomination. And they have the power to hire and fire, to disfellowship you, to embarrass you in the multitude of the congregation, and or, you know, assign you to hell. They exercise, or at least they think they have that power. And the independents, who don't have a worldwide church of congregations, but just have their own personal ministry, they're worse yet. You know, when you take people like Paul Crouch. I mean, there's not a Paul Crouch church, I don't think, where you go and listen to Paul Crouch preach every Sunday. I don't know. Benny Hinn has a church, I think, but I don't think he pastors it, though. He has others. Then you have some who do pastor a church, like John Hagee and Joel Osteen and some of those. And then you have others, again, Creflo Dollar, he's got a congregation. And others, like Joyce Myers, I don't know if she has a congregation she pastors every Sunday or not. But most of those, their big thing is television, their television ministry, and, you know, where they go and rent these convention centers. Swaggart. Yeah, Swaggart is back. Jim Baker is back. Now, how do they show their authority? We talk about authority and government, hierarchy, all of these things, power, rulership, you know, obey those that have the rule over you. The one thing that these people want is your money. Okay? They want your money. You listen to Creflo Dollar and Joyce Myers and Paula White and all. They want your money. They all want you to be prayer partners and just call them warriors and partners and all of that in their work. They want your money. Now, anybody who can control your money is exercising great authority over you. Okay? Anybody who can claim your money. Now, here's the thing. They don't say, give me your money. I mean, they're not that stupid. People would see through that. They say, give God your money, and here's where to send it. Huh? Can you see that? If you're watching Paula White and you want to obey all these, and it's every program, I mean, it's nonstop. That girl got dollar signs just flipping in her eyes. That woman is obsessed with worldlyism, materialism, money, clothes, jewelry, home, jets, power. The woman is absolutely possessed of it. So she teaches all these every morning, every day, all these rules and regulations and building the foundation and the you know, last year it was 07, the year of completion. This year God is going to complete His blessings on you. Well, what do you do in 08 then? Oh, 08 is the number of resurrection. This is the year you're going to be resurrected into the new, and 09 is when you know some other thing. And it's like used car salesman and car salesman. Any car salesman, new or used, worth their salt on the face of the earth, can give you a reason why this day, today, not tomorrow, today is the best time to buy a car at their dealership. Here's a reason why. If they don't have reasons, they make them up. They make them up. We have too many cars. We've got to reduce them and get rid of the inventory. You know? It's a July sale. It's a this sale. It's a manager sale. It's some kind of a sale. There's always a reason why today. And so these ministers will never run out of ammunition. Not only can they tell you why 08 is the year that you're supposed to do all this, but they can tell you on Tuesday why Tuesday is the day of the month of the year that you're supposed to do this. All nonsense. Just unbelievable nonsense. But they quote scriptures from the Bible and stuff. And lo and behold, people, two things. Either greed sets in or fear. And sometimes they use both, fear and greed. People are told if they don't tithe, they're robbing God. And if you rob God, you're a thief. And if you're a thief, you'll go to hell. But they're also told if you do tithe, He'll open up the windows of heaven and pour you out all these material blessings. Cars, money, diamonds, furs, whatever, you know. So greed and fear, and they all use it. And they use it well. Those that use it the best, they make the most. But the one that gets me is, you give it to God. Show God. Give it to God. How do you do that? You give it to me. They put themselves in the place of God. When you give to Paula White, you're giving to God. What does that tell you? Come on, people, wake up. Paula White, Joyce Myers, Creflo Dollar are not God. couldn't get me to give them a dollar, I'll tell you that. And look at him, Paul Crouch. $1 million everything. I mean, you know, everything they have is in the $1 million range. He's got a horse ranch, you know. A bunch of people bought that $5 million mansion. And they own real estate all over the place. I mean, they are, you know, I think they were offered $13 billion for TBN Network. $13 billion. You know, that's a real goal. Now, there's a goose that lays the golden egg.
Benny Hinn takes in nearly $100 million a year.
Spends $2,000 a night for a hotel. What kind of an apostle of God or evangelist or pastor does that? $2,000. Do you know how nice a room you can get for $275? You get the nicest rooms in the best hotels. Now, granted, you go to some of your, you know, more luxurious places, you'll pay $500 a night. But $2,000? These people have materialistic appetites. It's just beyond belief. Creflo Dollar. I saw a picture of his house from the air. It looks like a small city. You know, so many angled roofs and, you know. No, that's one house.
He brags about his Rolls Royce or Bentley or whatever he drives. Paula White has a $700,000 mansion in Texas.
She has a condo in Trump Tower. I don't think anything in that tower sells for less than $2 or $3 million. And a $2.5 million in Tampa mansion, and then more property in Malibu, and a private jet, and on and on and on and on. And she's a newcomer on the block. She's only been around for half a dozen years or less.
Dr. Sharona,
he's on TBN a lot. He wears 365 new pairs of shoes every year. How could somebody who wears 365 a new pair of shoes every day, how could somebody like that be a spiritual leader? What in the world does he have to offer spiritually to anybody? Somebody who is that far off their rocker that they need a new pair of shoes every day. When there's millions of people don't own one pair of shoes any day. And Benny Hinn in these $2,000 night rooms. I heard him say with my own ears that people who are not sending money in to TBN to spread the gospel, there are people who will go to hell because you're not sending money to TBN. He spends $2,000 a night for a hotel room. Wake up, people.
Fred Price likes to brag about his Rolls Royce. Kenneth Copeland says he and Creflo Dollar are going to be the first Christian billionaires.
Did you all see those jets? I sent you the pictures of the jets. You know, the last one on the list, Kenneth Copeland, he's got a more expensive jet than Paul Crouch. Paul Crouch's jet costs $16 million and some. Kenneth Copeland, $20 million. And he's got another one for his wife. They both have a $20 million jet. And they claim to represent Jesus Christ and the gospel to poor people around the world. Are you crazy? How do they get that money? Authority. They make people think that they're sitting in the seat of authority. God's government. And we're going to see what the Bible has about say about God's government in the church. Because I said it's the shortest subject in the Bible.
All right, let's move on now to the infamous Mr. Armstrong, the dictator of all religious dictators.
And, you know, I could talk about him because I knew him. Not only did I eat dinner at his table, but he laid hands on me. God forbid, but it happened. Okay, so anyway, this man uses more fear than reward. Some of them talk about reward, getting blessing, 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 but Herbert is more fear. He was more fear. And he would write these semi-annual letters and co-worker letters, and it was always, year after year, decade after decade, every letter, this is the most urgent. This is the very most urgent appeal I have ever had to make to you. Every letter. And just all caps, underline, exclamation points, you know, if you don't send in your money, this work will not get done. God will hold you responsible that this message, you know, every letter. And they were long letters. Legal paper, 5 and 6 pages each. Sometimes more. It was interesting, one time, my regional director, Paul Flatt, was down, and they knew that, you know, I knew what was going on. So anyway, they're trying to get me straightened out and so on. I said, Paul, let me read you something. So I read something about, brethren, this is the most urgent time in our lives. At this point in the work, you know, we are starting to struggle. We really need, you know, and on and on and on. You got to send your money now. This work will go under. This is the most urgent time. And I just read a little bit. I said, do you know when he sent that letter? This was so funny. Mr. Flatt said, that was the co-worker letter before this last one, wasn't it? I said, no, Paul, that was in 1934. And then I showed it to him. He thought, where the heck did you get a hold of that? By the way, it also happened to be the year 33 or 30, I believe 1934, when he wrote a letter to his then Seventh-day Church of God or whatever he was starting to get going. He wrote a letter about church government. And guess what? He put down every principle that he stands for, that he stood for in later years. Everything. He had it nailed. He went through the scriptures and he had it nailed. Turned his back on all of those scriptures. And when somebody brought it to his attention, back in about the 70s, I believe, said, you know, you wrote this, you know, you wrote this in the Good News or whatever, on church government. And you know, here's what you said. This is the total opposite of how... And you know what he said to that? He said, well, you know, a lot of people accuse me, I never change. But then when I do, they accuse me too. That was his answer to that. I could tell you stories, I'm telling you. Anyway, but this man also, he just obsessed with power, prestige, materialism, pleasures. He owned, well, he's dead now, of course, but he owned a mansion like catty corner across the street of Orange Grove Boulevard from the Wrigley's Chewing Gum Mansion, which took up one square block, by the way. One house, one block. Herbert Armstrong's house is really the only one on that block, too. But then to the east a little further, there's the Italian sunken garden. So it isn't that his house takes the whole block, but it's a big house worth probably, I don't know, $5 to $10 million today. But then he had another lavish home in Big Sandy and another one in Phoenix. And another one in Brickett Wood. And of course, he would go to those places, you know, via jet. Many people don't know Walt Disney. Walt Disney, I forget when he died. But anyway, Walt Disney's pilot was Captain Black. And he was Mr. Armstrong's pilot. When Disney was gone, he went to work for Mr. Armstrong as the captain. And, of course, he had the best jet, the Gulfstream II,
But then they also had, you know, the King Air and the French Falcon, and, you know, they had their own little air force. Herbert Armstrong had his own private cook, maid, chauffeurs, limos. He claimed $300,000 salary. But like I've said so often, screw up the heck with the salary. Just give me the expense account. I don't want a salary. Just give me my own expense account. But $300,000, that was pretty hefty back then, you know. But he always carried with him, wherever he went, $10,000 in cash. This was like for tips and stuff. Listen, there are stories, people went with him to, you know, some fine restaurant in Los Angeles. He would tip so large that even the waiters, it would be totally embarrassed. I mean, it's just obscene how much he would tip. Just totally obscene, you know. But it would just show his arrogance, that's all. When he took a lot of his trips, he also had, I don't know exactly how this, it was set up like a, it was set up as a special account so that, I don't know, nobody would know where the money went except, you know, he and his financial advisor or whatever. But he would have $100,000. Like, he'd go to England, he'd have, you know, the $10,000 cash, which was like tip money. And then he had this $100,000 in case he wanted to buy stuff. And, of course, it's reported that on occasion he would have to send back to re-up it another $100,000 and sometimes $300,000 on one trip. He needed an extra $300,000. Where did he get this money? From those co-worker letters saying, brethren, this gospel's got to go out. Just crazy. He would buy vast treasures, art, silver, gold, whatever. It's also known now that Herbert Armstrong had a secret millions of dollars bank account in Switzerland. He had money tucked away for a rainy day. I can't get too overboard here because my wife's a little younger than me, but when Armstrong was 84, he married a girl in her 30s. That's a little bit of a stretch. However, maybe this one even tops it. Dr. Lochner, I don't know where he was, in some educational thing, got his doctor. I don't know how he came to Ambassador College, but, you know, a lot of people think this was really a stupid, you know, how could anybody believe this stupid college and stuff? Listen, you didn't go, you haven't seen it. You didn't see it like we saw it, you know? I mean, we had, you know, important people come there. Presidents, premiers, kings, you know? King Leopold and movie stars from Hollywood. And I once took on a tour of Ambassador College the head of the World Court. Franz Josef Strauss. You know, important people come to that college. This is not, you know, you say, well, yeah, in retrospect now, and we learned everything behind this. We didn't see all that at the time. But Dr. Lochner, he was the head of Imperial Schools. There was Ambassador College, and then for all the workers and stuff, you understand, there were 3,000 workers out there in Pasadena. They had Imperial Schools, elementary, high school, and so on, a full school system. Dr. Lochner was head of that. And by the way, one of the people in my freshman class was Dr. Farrow from Oregon. Dr. Farrow was over the entire Oregon school system. And he was a freshman with me at Ambassador College. It's amazing stuff. You can't believe some of this stuff. Robert Kuhn had to work. They made you do this. It was like a humbling thing. You had at least one semester or something. Even if you had the money to pay your tuition, you had to work. He worked with me in the bindery. And he had a PhD in brain neurology. Can you believe that? I remember Dr. Hay came through the printing plant one day, and Dr. Kuhn and I were working on the line feeding, you know, the stuff in for the bins for the Plain Truth being stitched together and so on. And Dr. Hay came over. I forget who this dignitary was, some important person. And he said something like, he said, here at Ambassador College, we've learned that for people to be successful, sometimes they have to start at the bottom and show their true character and so on. He said, therefore, you know, whoever, you know, whatever, so and so, I would like you to meet Dr. Kuhn. stuffing magazines in a collating line. I mean, it's just, stuff is so bizarre sometimes. It's just, you know. I mean, who with a, you know, doctor's degrees would come and be a fresh, you know, well, they had to take certain basic courses if they were going to be used in work, and it started out in the freshman level. But anyway, so Dr. Lochner, he became, after a while, somebody else, I think, took over the school system there at Imperial Schools after his wife died. And then he started to travel. He was like, you know, the companion to Herbert Armstrong, kind of his aide and, you know, I don't know what you'd call him. And he traveled with him all around the world. And so Dr. Lochner realized, you know, that Herbert was around some certain hanky-panky and so on. So, and Herbert liked to drink, so Dr. Lochner would just get him drinking, you know, and get him drunk. And then, you know, people, their mouth loosens up sometimes, their tongue. And he would record, he'd secretly record all this stuff, and they'd be talking about who knows what, you know, all kinds of things about sex and what Herbert did and stuff. He recorded all that, you know, in case he needed it in the future, which he did. And he used that for blackmail. So even after Herbert fired him, he still collected, I don't know, $50,000 or $100,000 a year for life. Mm-hmm. For life. Oh, let me tell you this. So Dr. Lochner, after his wife died, he was 64 at the time then, or, you know, sometime thereafter. I know he was 64 years old, and he decided to get married. Okay, and he did. He got married to a 19-year-old. 19-year-old. That's a little bizarre. Anybody who knew Mr. Armstrong personally behind the scenes will attest that he was an arrogant, egotistical megalomaniac. Although, in public, he carried himself as a very sophisticated, you know. I mean, when he walked in a room, there was a certain hush came over. You know, he was a man of, you know, of authority. Yeah, but I mean, even, you know, I mean, he wore like, I don't know, $5,000 suits or whatever. Everything was handmade, you know, the finest material on earth and so on. And, you know, so he had a certain, I mean, when you wear everything, you know, when your eyeglasses cost $3,000 or whatever, you can see that. I mean, people can just see that, you know. Don't you notice when they show movie stars on TV, you know, they don't have sunglasses off the Ray-Ban rack or whatever at the dollar store, you know. You can say, that's expensive stuff. You can just see it, you know. And, but so he, in public, you know, he was sort of, you know, he was a dignified man for sure. But behind the scenes, you know, people knew what he was. And although he bragged a little bit in public, not so much. I mean, more than needful for sure, but not enough that people, you know, thought of him as being just an arrogant egotist, you know. But, you know, it's interesting, Bobby Fischer, you all remember Bobby Fischer, he was a world champion chess player. And there for years he disappeared. And remember how everybody was saying, where is Bobby Fischer? Where is Bobby Fischer? Nobody in the world knew for years and years. Nobody in the world knew where Bobby Fischer was. I knew where he was. he was living with Art McCarroll. You know Art McCarroll, don't you, Denny? He was living with Art McCarroll. But anyway, one day
And Bobby Fischer tells about this in the Ambassador Review. It was put out by John Trecek. John Trecek and I shared a room together, a dormitory room, at Ambassador College. He later wrote Ambassador Review and Ambassador Report. But anyway, Bobby Fischer tells John Trecek that one day Herbert, wanting to show him around the college, and he's and Bobby says, every place they went, Mr. Armstrong said, you see all this? I built this. And he'd say, yes, Mr. Armstrong, you really did good. And you see this? This is the finest auditorium, you know, and so on. And, you know, he said, boy, you really did good, Mr. Armstrong. And you see all this? I had this all landscape. This is the best landscaping, you know. You know, Ambassador College won the most beautiful college campus in the world 3 years in a row. There was nothing on the earth that could compare with it. So then they made a rule. You can only win 3 years in a row. You can't keep winning, you know. He said, I get the best lane. Yes, Mr. Armstrong, you really did quite a job. Yes, Mr. Yes, I can see Mr. Armstrong. You really, really an amazing man, you know. And so Bobby Fischer just pumping up his ego because he saw that that's what he wanted. But, you know, it just makes an interesting story, you know. Man was all ego.